It is Wednesday, June 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a political newcomer defeats a prominent New York City congressman. International experts meet in Paris to discuss the crisis in Yemen, and a new Los Angeles-based boy band releases a new single. It's all ahead. A 28-year-old political newcomer, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Tuesday defeated longtime New York Congressman Joe Crowley in a stunning Democratic primary election upset. New York's 14th district includes Queens and the Bronx. Ocasio-Cortez was born in the Bronx, and her mother is from Puerto Rico. Jeffrey Skelly is a political analyst at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. He tells me what the result means for the Democratic Party and for New York City.
Well, yeah, I mean, Joe Crowley has been in Congress since he was elected in 1998, and he had built up a very strong position, held a number of important roles in the Democratic caucus in the House. He was chair of the House Democratic Caucus, for example. So he was someone who had been touted as a potential future Speaker of the House. But I think it means that a longtime leader is gone, or will be gone, after November, and that the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House may be shaken up, not even just because of Crowley's defeat, but if Democrats do win a majority in the House, you know, it's very possible that someone like Nancy Pelosi might have a difficult time holding on to her position as the leader of the party.
Is age a factor here, or is ethnicity?
I would go with ethnicity more. Age, you know, actually, Joe Crowley isn't that old. He's been there for a long time, yes, but he's only in his 50s. And there are a lot of members in the leadership and elsewhere, both parties, that are a lot older than 56. So for me, it comes down to a few factors. I mean, I think you can't really nail one thing as being responsible for all this. But look, Joe Crowley was a white Irish Catholic representing a district that had become very, very diverse from a race and ethnicity standpoint, going from one that when he was first elected, his original district, when he was first elected back in the late 90s, was roughly about 50% white, you know, give or take a little bit. And today, the district he represents is, you know, around a quarter white. You know, got a lot of large Latino population. And so, to some extent, I think it's his challenger, Ocasio-Cortez, she may have just fit the district better than Crowley did. And she went after Crowley on a few different issues, including sort of his close ties to developers and where he was getting his money from for fundraising, because, I mean, he had 10 times as much money as she did, at least from the campaign finance reports, and that became one of her attacks on him. And she ran very much to the left, but, you know, to some extent, Crowley was already pretty liberal and befitting one of the most liberal districts in the country. And so, you know, perhaps the best way to look at this is that she was just a better fit for the district in terms of who she is, her background, and the makeup of the district.
Ms. Ocasio-Cortez is, I believe she considers herself a Democratic socialist, so she's quite far left of Mr. Crowley. I mean, could this be, I know this is New York City in a certain particular district, but does this indicate, though, that there is a greater strength, perhaps, in the future among candidates who run on, say, the far left of the Democratic Party?
I think in certain parts of the country, that may be possible. In the sense that in a very liberal district in New York City or Boston or Los Angeles or something like that, you know, maybe this, even saying you're a Democratic socialist could find, you know, a receptive audience. I don't think that it's necessarily about to take over the Democratic Party. I know in the aftermath of Crowley's defeat that there have been a lot of hot takes about how this is somehow indicative of the overall direction of the Democratic Party, but I think really what it suggests is that there are national factors to consider here, you know, national trends but there also were very important local factors to how this happened. But, you know, the national trends, it's true. If you look at young voters, there have been a number of polls that have gotten a lot of attention that have shown younger voters are somewhat skeptical of capitalism, for example, or they have mixed views on socialism and capitalism, and they end up roughly splitting as to which system they think is better. I do think a binary question like that isn't necessarily all that helpful, because obviously there's space in between the most extreme forms of socialism and capitalism. We live in a mixed market economy, for goodness sake, you know, not pure capitalism. So anyway, I find that to be, maybe people are stressing out about that a little too much. But I do think that there, you know, the success that Bernie Sanders had in the 2016 presidential cycle, and at least in terms of attracting young voters particularly, and the fact that you do have polls that suggest that younger voters are more open to aspects of, you know, social democracy or democratic socialism, whatever you want to call it, you know, that would suggest that perhaps this is going to become a part of the Democratic Party and be the left wing of the Democratic Party. That, you know, that I think is quite possible.
Jeffrey Skelly, political analyst at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. President Donald Trump seemed to take particular delight in Crowley's defeat. Crowley has been a frequent Trump critic, and as Skelly said, he'd been mentioned as a possibility to someday replace Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the minority Democratic bloc in the House of Representatives. Trump tweeted, "Wow, big Trump hater Congressman Joe Crowley, who many expected was going to take Nancy Pelosi's place, just lost his primary election. In other words, he's out. That's a big one that nobody saw happening. Perhaps he should have been nicer and more respectful to his president." Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Afghanistan's president seeks direct talks with the leader of the Taliban. The U.S. Supreme Court deals a major blow to public unions. President Trump urges passage of an immigration overhaul. And the South Sudanese government signs a ceasefire with rebels. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
In a minute.
President Donald Trump recently signed a new memorandum directing the United States to lead the management of space traffic and step up efforts to track, monitor, and reduce the effects of orbiting space debris. Called Space Policy Directive 3, the White House says the new order will provide needed guidelines and direction to ensure that the United States is a leader in providing a safe and secure environment as commercial and civil space traffic increases. Scientists estimate that there are some 750,000 pieces of space junk circling Earth, and millions more if you count the fragments smaller than 1 centimeter. A mere fleck of paint flying around in space at average impact speeds of 10 kilometers per second could severely damage a spacecraft, or even worse, harm or kill an astronaut performing work outside of a spacecraft. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the boy band In Real Life releases a new single, Tattoo. Germany's fragile government coalition was unable to resolve a dispute over migrant policy late Tuesday that threatens the rule of Chancellor Angela Merkel going into a crucial 2-day European Union summit Thursday and Friday. Ms. Merkel's political ally, the Christian Social Union, is demanding a tougher line on turning away migrants at the border who are registered in another EU country. as Merkel faces a Sunday deadline on a compromise. The migration of hundreds of thousands from Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia over the past 3 years is now the most pressing issue facing a divided EU. It has mostly led to the formation of Italy's populist coalition government, which has adopted a get-tough policy in recent weeks. Benoit Capmark, a senior lecturer in global politics at Australia's RMIT University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Italian election appears to have been a watershed event on migration.
Yes, it has been significant because the previous Italian administrations had tried to put forth the issue to the EU, generally speaking, that they were, as it were, disproportionately fielding arrivals and refugee arrivals and irregular immigrants, as it were, and to no avail, that actually very little was done about that. And so the shock tactics, if you like, certainly regarding the recent approaches of the Italian government, which consists of, for example, the Lega, the Northern League politicians, individuals like Matteo Salvini, these are individuals who are very clear that they want to put immigration on the map as a critical European issue.
This matter could spell the end of the fragile coalition in Germany, too.
Yes, it's a very fragile coalition, as you rightly point out, and Angela Merkel is actually facing a considerable crisis at home. Chancellor Merkel, of course, has her own problems with her interior minister, who is insisting, of course, on a tougher line and insisting that the border policies have to be reevaluated, broadly speaking. So there's disharmony on that front, and there's disharmony, of course, in several other countries where there are similar problems in lack of unity.
Have you noticed a change in the so-called open-door border system that is called the Schengen system, and is that in threat right now?
Well, technically speaking, it's been abridged, shall we say, for some years, because the issue of Schengen, even though it's still very much on paper functioning, has been altered somewhat by various countries within different, shall we say, agreements. So, for example, the Visegrad country list, which is primarily, you know, states like the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and so forth, and they have a different approach. They claim, along the lines being taken by, like, say, with Hungary, Viktor Orban's Hungary, that tighter controls are needed. So even though on paper the Schengen zone still functions, in reality many states are individually trying to combat this, which of course goes against the spirit, as it were, of the EU format.
German Chancellor Merkel has stressed that she does not believe a European Union-wide deal on migration will come forth at this summit. If it doesn't, what happens?
Well, it'll be more of the same dramatic reactions that we've seen. Certainly the idea of, for example, pushing on vessels to other third parties and so forth, and I'm afraid that that's the sort of scene we're going to see more of if no actual agreement is made. And certainly the draft statement, which seems to be circulating at the moment, is changing, and the reality is that all leaders do agree that a functioning EU policy, as the draft statement so far goes, on immigration is effective control of the external borders. But of course, the problem is that it's the first countries, as it were, in line, such as Italy, who receive the bulk, as it were, of irregular arrivals from, you know, for example, Libya, and they're the ones who claim that they're simply shouldering too much of the burden and would like to have some kind of distribution system in place. But getting that equality of system is certainly not going to happen with the likes of Viktor Orban and the disagreements amongst the Visegrad countries.
Benoit Capmark of Australia's RMIT University. He said along with the financial pressures represented by struggling EU economies like Greece, migration also threatens to undermine the spirit of the Union's cohesion as a number of member countries adopt a go-it-alone policy in cracking down on the flow of migrants. Relief agencies have called for targeted sanctions against Yemen's warring parties and for international pressure to keep vital humanitarian assistance flowing as diplomats meet Wednesday on the country's crisis in Paris. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital, the meeting was downgraded after last week's Saudi-led coalition attack on Yemen's main port of Hodeida.
Co-chaired by France and Saudi Arabia, the Paris conference was to have been at a ministerial level, with French President Emmanuel Macron delivering a keynote speech. But those plans were scrapped following the Hodeida attack. Now the meeting was taking place among international experts, behind closed doors. Aid agencies are expressing concern about the risk of a new humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, which they say may affect hundreds of thousands of people. Rasha Moaiya is Yemen researcher at Amnesty International.
We have documented at Amnesty that over the past 6 months, the Saudi Arabia-led coalition have continued to impose the restrictions on the entry of essential goods into the conflict-ravaged Yemen. But we've also documenting that from the other side, the Houthi de facto authorities have excessively delayed the delivery of humanitarian assistance inside Yemen.
France and the United States are among the nations backing the Saudi coalition in the conflict. The French government faces pressure over its arms sales to both Saudi Arabia and coalition partner, the United Arab Emirates. The United Nations and other groups say the coalition has targeted civilians, which it denies. Moaiya says Amnesty and other humanitarian groups want the international community to impose targeted sanctions on warring parties who they say have violated international law.
We are calling on France as an ally to the Saudi Arabia and as a weapon selling countries to pressure Saudi Arabia in order to respect the law and to ensure that humanitarian assistance is delivered to the country.
Yemen's three-year-old war has killed thousands of people and displaced hundreds of thousands of others. Many face extreme hunger. Humanitarian groups fear the situation could worsen if the Hodeida port fighting cuts off the flow of aid. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. A new boy band has released its first single for 2018. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the details.
Well, Sarah, you know, last week we talked about a boy band, and this week we're talking about another boy band. This boy band are a new boy band, and they came together on a TV show on ABC television about a year ago called Boy Band, which was hosted by Rita Ora and Nick Carter of the Backstreet Boys, Emma Bunton of the Spice Girls, and Timbaland, who's a well-respected producer in music. The name of this boy band? In Real Life. That's what they've called themselves. So we're going to check out their debut single right now, right here, called Tattoo.
Called you up this time, I thought I'd be your shelter. You left me standing at your door. Kept you off my mind last weekend, but it felt worse. Now I'm back outside once more. Cause I like the rhythms you played, melodies making me sway, wanted some more. We were the talk of the day, should have been up on the stage, out on the floor. Something just pulled you away, happened in front of my face. What's all of this for? I'm still feeling the same. How about you?
It seems like we've been hearing a lot about boy bands recently.
Well, yeah, we've been hearing about boy bands for quite a while with NSYNC and all of the boy bands that have been out and about for a number of years. Recently, we've had artists like Shawn Mendes and Justin Bieber. A lot of male solo artists have been taking the spotlight. But there's still room for boy bands, and so we've got a new one on the scene out of Los Angeles that came together on the TV show called Boy Band. The premise of the show, very simply, there was many, many people who would compete. Many contestants, about 30 young guys, would come on and sing in front of the judges, and it would be determined who they would select to put into a boy band. So the whole idea of the show was to form a boy band. And so they came up with these guys, and I'm going to introduce you to the guys. Brady Tutton is one of the guys, and he's a movie actor. He appeared on an ABC sitcom called Fresh Off the Boat. He also appeared in a movie earlier this year called The Rocket. The boys also consist of Chance Perez, who had auditioned for America's Got Talent. He did not make it through. Drew Ramos, Sergio Calderon, and Michael Connor. They're all from Los Angeles, California. They didn't know each other before this TV show started. They did their little auditions, and the judges said, you're good, you're good, you're good. And then they became a band, and they came up with a name in real life. And now they've signed a contract with Hollywood Records, which is the same record company that started Miley Cyrus's career, and many other artists who've gone through the Disney Hollywood Records label. And so the new single is called Tattoo, How About You?, which follows up on a Christmas EP they had out right around the holiday time. But so far, no word on a full-length studio album yet from this boy band.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. All right, well, In Real Life brings us to an end of the show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past 5 years, the Feed the Future Nigeria Livelihoods Project has helped pull some of the most vulnerable families in Nigeria out of poverty. This U.S. government foreign assistance program has helped Nigerians improve agricultural production, income generation, nutrition, and sanitation. The $22.6 million program in Nigeria began in 2013 and concluded just last month. Administered by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and implemented by Catholic Relief Services, the program initially helped 42,000 poor households in Abuja, Nigeria's capital, Kebbi and Sokoto states, to increase agricultural production, diversify incomes, and improve nutrition. It also provided livelihoods planning skills, adult literacy and numeracy instruction, and cash transfers to the most vulnerable households. In 2017, the program expanded to Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe states, reaching 10,000 more households. This project took a holistic approach to agriculture, to livelihoods, and to social development, said USAID Mission Director Stephen Hagen. It addressed the needs of the extreme poor by improving incomes and reducing vulnerabilities, and in this way serving as a model for efforts to build resilience in rural Nigeria. The USAID program introduced new technology, improving agricultural production and access to input markets such as quality seeds for smallholder farmers. As a result, crop yields doubled for more than 33,000 farmers. The program also helped farmers to reduce post-harvest losses. The activity engaged poor households in the rural economy by providing business skills and financial literacy support, vocational trainings and lending schemes, and safe spaces for adolescent girls. Additionally, more than 2,000 community workers were trained to deliver over 1.5 million counseling and group sessions on nutrition. That led to a 22% drop in stunting, 10% drop in wasting, and 53% increase in exclusive breastfeeding rates in targeted locations. A cash transfer component alone helped lift 2,740 households out of poverty. State and local governments have shown positive support towards sustaining the gains from the program. The U.S. is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to improve the lives of the Nigerian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's up, Africa?